Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with contributors to Maple Leaf Rag 5, a new volume of writings from the long-running series at the Maple Leaf Bar. We'll hear from publisher John Travis and poets Nancy Harris and Steve Beisner. We'll also talk with Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan, whose new book is So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. The Maple Leaf Bar hosts one of, if not the oldest, running reading series in the South. Those Sunday afternoons of poetry have been going on at the Maple Leaf Bar for a long time. With us today are poet Nancy Harris, who took over the reading series after the death of Everett Maddox, publisher John Travis, who's just published Maple Leaf Rag 5, an anthology of poetic writings, New Orleans, and we'll also hear from poet Steve Beisner, who will read one of his works from the new anthology. Welcome, Nancy.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Way down there. Now, Nancy, let's start with you. How did this series get started in the first place, and how did you get involved with it?
Well, I was friends with Everett and Ralph Adamo and some other poets who were in town and at that point. And it was John Stoss, who doesn't live here anymore, told me one day, he said, Nancy, you've got to go over to the Maple Leaf. Everett and Bob Stock, the poets, and Franz Hellner, the painter, just started up a reading on Sundays, and last week was the first one. So I missed the very first one, but I've been going ever since. It was, I think, June of 79.
Wow.
Was when they started.
So that's 35 years.
I know, my hair is gray now.
I've gone gray for poetry. I love it. So after Everett left us, you took over the work of keeping it going.
Yes, the first year, Julie Kane and Helen Toy, we were all doing it. And for various reasons, Julie quit her job and went to graduate school. And my friend Helen, her work was getting in the way. So somehow I got by de facto or whatever, default or whatever, I was left holding the sign-up sheet I've been doing it for 25 years.
25 years. It's an amazing thing. Yeah. So what do you get out of doing it? That's a lot of effort to put into something.
Well, I went there every Sunday, you know, while Everett was doing it, and it was just my Sunday church. And what else would I do on Sunday afternoon besides hang around poets and drink and read poetry and talk about poetry? So it just was a natural thing to do.
And we should say poets from all over the country and really all over the world have read at the Maple Leaf, haven't they?
Everywhere. I had this poet from Singapore about 2 years ago. And he found out about it in the tourist guidebook for New Orleans. So all kinds of people show up.
So every poet knows that's the place to go every Sunday at 3 o'clock. There's a lot to be said for being regular, you know. So what are some of the changes you've seen in the poetry scene in New Orleans over the years?
Well, when we first started, it was the Maple Leaf, Robert Borsodi's Coffee House.
Oh, yeah.
And Lee Grew's Backyard Poetry Theater, which was only a monthly reading. So basically those three places. And now it's just exploded with, I haven't even been to every place that has readings. And,
isn't it amazing?
Yeah. But, you know, even at that point when they started, there wasn't live music there. It was just a jukebox and a chess table and a laundromat in the back.
And the laundromat in the back is the stuff of war,
right. You know. And so not only did the poetry scene explode, but also the live music was just everywhere.
Yeah. You know?
So I think we were at the beginning of something, mm-hmm. a renaissance.
And has this given you fuel for your own work? Has this nourished your life as a poet?
Yes. Listening to other people read. And I like it when people from different parts of the country come read because it gives you a perspective on what's going on nationally, not just in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. And John, when did you start publishing the Maple Leaf anthologies?
Well, I've done four of them. Maxine Cassin published the first one in, I think it was 1993. She did the first one in 1980. And then it was a pretty good little span after that. And I came along and, again, it was Ralph Adamo and a few others. And my first book that I published was American Waste by Everett Maddox.
Right.
A posthumous book written on bar napkins and bar coasters. And, you know, the next year we did The Maple Leaf Rag. You know, I was really encouraged by publisher Maxine Cassin.
Yeah.
So it's just a special place. So much sharing of life experience. That's what makes it so special to me. And Nancy is so welcoming, you know. Mm-hmm. I think every poet reads there gets an A or a B, you know, just for trying, you know. And we have a lot of rookie poets, you know. Just,
oh, of course.
You know, and then you have veterans, too, that have been published, like John Gary and many others that have published several books. So to me, I'm just glad I got to make a little contribution to the literary arts here in New Orleans.
So putting an anthology like this together is a lot of work. Ooh. How did you put this latest one together?
It is a lot of work, you know, especially if you're, you know, doing it partly by yourself. I had some help with photography, a photographer and a poet named Edgar Sierra helped a lot. Mike True helped with some artwork and some design. And Nancy helps by, you know, encouraging people to contribute. You know, I have to track people down, though. You know, Portals is about 20 years old here in New
Orleans. That's amazing, too. Congratulations.
Yeah, I've earned a few gray hairs, too. Yeah.
Oh, man. So do you take everything that people send you, or do you go through and choose and select? Or?
Oh, I have to select it. You know, this anthology, each anthology is a sampling. If you do the math, you know, 50 weeks, you know, you got to take off a week for the Saints game or something like that, you know.
Every Christmas. Now and then, yeah.
Playoffs, baby. But 50 times, you know, it's been 4 years since the last anthology. So if you figure about 10 readers per week, so 50 times 10, that's 500. Multiply that times 4 years, you're talking about 2,000. So, you know, some of those are repeats and stuff. Mm-hmm. So even 1,000 poems in the last 4 years, I mean, that's a lot to, you know. So this anthology is what I hope is a worthy record of, you know, people sharing their life experiences. And
right. There's so much in it. Now, you know, you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but the cover is so charming. It's this fabulous archway that says poetry across the top. And there is Nancy, who looks like the high priestess. So how did you put that together? Where is that? People, it's going to look familiar to people, I think.
Yeah, it's one of the doorways, portals to the municipal auditorium. You just go in, enter from Armstrong Park from the French Quarter, and you take a little left there in the municipal auditorium. I think it's under renovation, right? Mm-hmm. And it's got these portals, art, music, poetry, drama, and athletics, I think. And so, you know, I just picked one of them out, and I wanted to put somebody inside there. And, you know, since Nancy's been doing it for 25 years, I thought it would be good for her. But we also didn't, you know, want it to just be Nancy, you know, be more of a symbol, like goddess of poetry or something like that. So that's why her image is a little bit blurry, you know, in a
but
sense.
But it's gorgeous.
But, yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Now, Steve, you're a poet, and I want you to talk a little bit about going to the Maple Leaf. How long have you gone? How many times have you read there? What does it mean to you?
Well, I'm definitely the newcomer here. I first went to the Maple Leaf a few months after Katrina in early January of 2006. And the thing that struck me, having read poetry, you know, in several places around the country, was how comfortable it felt and how welcoming the people were. I liked what Nancy said about church, because it is sort of that feeling of community and welcoming and no snobbery or anything. That, you know, if you could be a beginner or you could be a professional who's been doing writing for years, and in any case, you'll get the same warm welcome. And I've hardly missed a time. If I'm in New Orleans, I will be at the Maple Leaf on Sunday afternoon.
And I love it that in New Orleans, you can say you're a newcomer and you've been doing something for 7 years.
Yeah.
Now, when I was reading this anthology, and it is such a pleasure because there's so many different types of poems in this. There literally is something for everyone. But Steve, I have to say that your poem kind of struck me as a poem of place that was so loving and appropriate for the Maple Leaf. So I wonder if you'd read that poem for us. It's called Hold Her Close.
New Orleans has wet and mud where people walk and stand and know the earth they're living on and how it feels to hold her close. Through her nearby marshes, oil canals cut obscenely straight and narrow, run miles through watery green, a highway of danger for muskrats and nutria. Leafy sinews strangle the house who lost her family 2 summers ago. Soon, with no friend, losing her battle with flora, ruin. Potholes kill and eat in cautious cars, where there's guns enough that someone always wants to see what steel and absent hope can do. You choose your costume for the day to say, yesterday is gone, tomorrow's not come, and you got 1 shot at now. Overhead, the white cloud virginal bandana floats, a hand waving, saying, my life's an all-night dance, and I mean something by it. The lady says, how you doing, and really wants you to know that different got it all over respectable, and a little crazy ain't bad either. You're no stranger after a beer and swapped stories in the cool dark bar. You want today's road to be one you'll still remember tomorrow. The meanings of barroom stories are not in the words, but how they dart and pause, unwrap and disrobe the tellers. New Orleans has wet and mud where people walk and stand and know the earth they're living on and how it feels to hold her close.
I love that poem, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. So you all recently had a celebration at the Maple Leaf of the anniversary. What was that like for you, especially you, Nancy, to look back on so many years? Was it like, this is your life?
Well, the reading we had this Sunday for the anthology, we had almost 40 readers. It went on so long, a few people had to leave early. We had 2 poet laureates, one, the Julie Kane, the last one, and Ava Lavelle Hayman, the new one, and everybody else in between.
A poetry marathon.
Right.
Oh, well, it sounds just great, and congratulations, and thank you for keeping this thing going. It's so important to life here. We've been talking with Nancy Harris, John Travis, and Steve Beisner, who are all celebrating the publication of Maple Leaf Rag 5, an anthology of poetic writings New Orleans. Check out the readings at the Maple Leaf Bar any and almost every Sunday at 3 p.m. You can also see Nancy and John and other Maple Leaf poets Saturday, September 6th at Ladder Library at the Poetry Buffet at 2 o'clock. Thanks so much, you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maureen Corrigan is one of my favorite book people. You probably know her as the book critic for Fresh Air and the author of the wonderfully titled Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She teaches literature at Georgetown University, where she's the critic in residence, and she lives in Washington, D.C. with her husband Rich Yesselson and daughter Molly. I was lucky enough to serve with Maureen on the Pulitzer jury for fiction in 2012, so this is a happy reunion to discuss her bright and spirited new book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. Maureen, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you, Susan. It's great to be talking to you again.
I know. Now, one of the things I love most about So We Read On is that it's such a love story. It's a love story of a woman in a book.
It is. You know, it's a love story that also didn't start out well, as so many classic love stories seem to follow that pattern. I first read The Great Gatsby in high school, as so many Americans do, and I remember thinking, it's kind of boring, and it's about rich people, and I can't relate. And of course, since then, many decades on, I must have read it at least 50 times. I've taught it almost every year of my teaching life. I've traveled around the country for the Big Read program, sponsored by the National Endowment for the Arts, talking about Gatsby. And along the way, I fell deeply in love. I do believe it's our greatest American novel.
Well, you're very convincing when you make your argument. I love the way you explore the water imagery, the idea of Gatsby as a noir novel, how intricately patterned it is. Any reader who reads The Great Gatsby is going to get so much more out of it after reading your book.
Thank you. You know, one of the things that really came to the fore as I was writing it, because I feel like I learn something new, of course, every time I dive into Gatsby, is just how saturated the novel is with water imagery. And for Fitzgerald, you know, he's always exploring the founding dare of America, sink or swim. You know, how long can you keep your head above water before you're inevitably pulled down and drowned by your own desire, by the nets of social class and the limitations of the American dream itself? I mean, from the very first page of Gatsby, we get water images jumping to the fore. And anybody who's read Gatsby remembers the famous chapter in the dead center of the book where Gatsby is reunited with Daisy. And I think people will remember that day that they're reunited. It's pouring cats and dogs. And Gatsby appears at Nick Carraway's cottage to surprise Daisy, his long-lost love. He's standing at the door, drenched, dripping, soaking wet, looking like a drowned man, which he will be, in a sense, by the end of the novel when he's dead in his own swimming pool. And, of course, Daisy, her great attraction, she's described as having a voice that sounds like money. She's like a siren, one of these water nymphs who pulls Gatsby down to his death.
Oh, this gives me the chills just hearing you talk about it. It's so much fun. One of the things I love about this book as well is that it is a literal journey. When you began to log all those miles around the country for the Big Read program, what did you find in the readers who were coming to Gatsby for that program?
Well, almost everyone was middle-aged who appeared at these events. And so the audience would tell me during question and answer period, it's a better novel than I remembered it as. I think Gatsby absolutely is one of those novels that we read too young. When we're in high school, maybe we identify with the obsessive love affair between Gatsby and Daisy, but we can't quite connect to the regret in Nick's voice, the sense of loss, the awareness of limitations. All of that comes through in Nick Carraway's voice as he's remembering the summer of 1922 when all of these events took place on Long Island. So that certainly is something that I heard over and over again on the tour. It's a better novel than I remembered.
Well, you know, Doris Lessing always used to say we should never read a book outside of its right time for us. And I think we do that a lot. And so it's good to go back again and again. And then for you, there were those trips to the archives, and Princeton, of course, where you saw Francis Cugat's painting, Celestial Eyes. That's the image for one of the most enduring book jackets in history. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about what it was like to spend time in the room with that painting.
I say in my book that it was almost as though the librarian had wheeled in the Statue of Liberty next to me as I was sitting in the archives with some of Fitzgerald's letters. How on earth do you work when you've got this icon next to you, you know, literally staring at you? That's certainly what it felt like. The painting itself, it's in the Princeton University Library. It's framed behind glass. The librarian who's in charge of that collection wheeled it into the archives. And one of the things I noticed immediately is it's an even stranger painting than it is a book jacket, because what we don't see on the reproductions of the original book jacket are all the numbers floating in the night sky. I mean, it's even more surrealistic than we realize when we see our paperback copies of Gatsby. I think that Fitzgerald was so lucky in Francis Cugat, the book jacket designer, who, by the way, that's the only book jacket he ever did. He was paid $100 for it, and Scribner's almost threw the original painting out. It was in a trash can of so-called publishing dead matter in Scribner's until someone fished it out at the last minute. But Cugat really understood that the point of Gatsby is about longing for something or someone who's going to be eternally out of reach. And that cover, the flapper's disembodied face floating over the night sky with the amusement park lights beneath her, really conveys that sense of you could reach for that face, you could reach for those lights, but you'll never quite grasp them.
And it was pretty overpowering for you as you tried to work, wasn't it?
I had to ask the librarian finally to wheel the painting out of the room. And, you know, I hated doing that because how many times am I going to have the chance to sit there with the original painting? But finally, I had a limited amount of time at Princeton, and I had so much I wanted to look at and read. I couldn't work with that painting next to me. It really has a power to it.
Well, hopefully you'll get to go back and see it and not be under pressure.
I hope so.
Now, the other thing you did, you made your share of pilgrimages to the places in Fitzgerald's life. You went around Long Island Sound on a floating walking tour of East and West Egg. You went to the Row House in Baltimore, where you met all these Fitzgerald enthusiasts on a sidewalk waiting for a real estate open house.
Oh, gosh, that was a day in late winter 2 years ago when I went to Baltimore because I had heard that the Row House, where Fitzgerald wrote Tender is the Night, was up for sale and there would be this open house. So I got up early. I drove from Washington to Baltimore. The street where the Row House is in the Bolton Hill section of Baltimore was packed with Fitzgerald lovers. And also what was nice was that many of these people were younger. It wasn't what I think of as sort of the typical NPR literary crowd who's usually middle-aged or older. A lot of these folks were college kids, maybe even some high school kids mixed in, which was lovely. We were all disappointed because the house had already been sold, and so the open house was canceled. But even though it was a chilly day, we stood on the sidewalk, so many of us talking about Fitzgerald, talking about Tender is the Night. I met people who were working on plays about Zelda. I met someone who said he was instrumental in having Scott and Zelda reburied in the plot that they currently are buried in Rockville, Maryland. I mean, it seemed like the sidewalk was just lousy with Fitzgerald experts, but I did kind of imagine the spirit of F. Scott Fitzgerald inside that row house, laughing at all of us behind bolted doors,
a
drink.
I imagine you on the sidewalk going, "These are my people."
Yeah, okay.
Now, one of the things, you know, when people do research in archives, there's this whole feeling of the hand that touched the hand that wrote the book. And how special that is. And you saw a lot of Fitzgerald relics, you know, you saw letters, first editions, this typewriter eraser that his daughter gave him, which I found so touching because I remember typewriter erasers. You know, even his briefcase. Where did you most feel him?
I think, hands down, I most felt him in his letters. Fitzgerald's letters stay with me, along with Gatsby, along with some of his short stories, and along with the essays in his crack-up collection. His voice just comes through so poignantly in his letters. So whenever I had the chance to read his letters, or even the reading lists that he made for people close to him. He was always making up lists of recommended reading for friends and lovers and even the nurses who tended to him when he was ill. I really felt that voice of Fitzgerald that so many of us love come through loud and clear. And I'm an unabashed worshiper of literary relics. I will genuflect before pens and, yes, typewriter erasers and briefcases because they do help me as a reader enter more fully into the life of these authors who create masterpieces that we can appreciate but we never can quite completely comprehend.
Well, and that's what you've done with this wonderful book. book. We've been talking with Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan, whose fine, fine new book is So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. Thank you so much, Maureen.
Oh, thank you, Susan. It's been a pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses Jess Walter's Beautiful Ruins, Tuesday, September 2nd at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Great Books Discussion Group talks about Plato's The Crito, Tuesday, September 2nd at 7 at the Old Metairie Branch Library. Three new local authors discuss and sign copies of their books, Tuesday, September 2nd at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Taniska Wilson signs her short story collection Proclivity. Cynthia Addison signs her story collection, The Devil Hates Marriages, and Ray Woodruff signs her memoir, Born Special. Katie Simpson-Smith signs The Story of Land and Sea, Wednesday, September 3rd at 7 at the Columns Hotel, 3811 St. Charles Avenue, at an event sponsored by Maple Street Bookshop, and again, Thursday, September 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. Carol McMichael Reese leads a panel discussion with contributors to the book New Orleans Under Reconstruction, The Crisis of Planning. She and Elizabeth Mossop, Jean Nathan, Raymond Manning, Bradford Powers, and David Wagner discuss and sign the book Thursday, September 4th from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Author Johnette Downing presents a concert at the New Orleans Jazz National Historical Park Visitor Center Friday, September 5th from 11 to noon. After the concert, Downing signs copies of her books at A Tisket, A Tasket. Mark Shapiro signs Carbon Shock, a tale of risk and calculus on the front lines of a disrupted global economy, Friday, September 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, John Travis, Nancy Harris, and Steve Beisner, appear as part of the celebration of Maple Leaf Rag 5, Saturday, September 6th at 2 p.m. at Ladder Library. That's part of the monthly poetry buffet. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans meets Monday, September 8th at 6 at Candace Huber's new Tubby & Coos Mid-City Bookshop, 631 South Carrollton. The Monday Night Writers Group meets every Monday at 7:30 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Morgan Moulthrop discusses and signs Andrew Jackson's playbook, 15 Strategies for Success, Tuesday, September 9th at 6 at Octavia Books. STARE, Start the Adventure in Reading, begins training for tutors who work with school kids for the coming academic year. Classes are available Saturday, September 6th from 9:30 to 11:30 at the Land Building, 1535 State Street, or Monday, September 8th from 1:30 to 3:30 at Covington Presbyterian Church. To sign up, please call 504-899-0820 or email elizabeth@starenola.org. If you'd like to brush up your creative writing skills this fall, Loyola University's Walker Percy Center for Writing and Publishing is offering classes at locations uptown, downtown, and on the North Shore, with classes in poetry, short story, screenplay, creative nonfiction, and developing a writing practice. Classes begin the week of September 22nd. For more information and to register, check out loino.edu/WPC/Loyola-Writing-Institute. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.